We're also dealing with a problem in Iraq. Now, the problem in Iraq, like the problem in Syria, is a problem of America's making. There wasn't a problem in Iraq before America invaded Iraq, but there's a hell of a problem now. Most recently, the Iraq security forces, the Iraq military, that would be the Shiite military in Iraq that's equipped with American weapons, fled from Tariq. They gave up the town to the Islamic State. Now you've got the United States and Iran trying to help, we'll put that in air quotes, Iraq. Well, the fact is, the United States broke Iraq and gave it to Iran. And the United States is providing weapons and consultation, and Iran is providing mujahideen. The Iranian mujahideen are much more effective than the Iraqi army. But if you want evidence that America gave Iraq to Iran, the only troops that are making a difference against the Islamic State in Iraq today are Iranian. Now, this article from CNN says, why should we care? And the fact is, we shouldn't care. I mean, that's the bottom line, is we shouldn't care. We shouldn't care about what's going on in Syria. We shouldn't care about what's going on in Iraq. We can't make the situation better. But this CNN article has all sorts of talking heads say that we should care because it's Americans that are going over there to fight, and those Americans are going to come back. When they come back, they're going to be terrorists. Why will they be terrorists, Glenn? What do you think will prompt them to commit terrorist acts against America when these Islamic jihadists return from Iraq?
Could be the baseline training of Islamic doctrine, for starters, and also could be bitterness when they see all the devastation that all our wonderful efforts over the past several decades have wrought in Iraq and in places around the world.
Yep. Yeah, primarily Islam and the jaundiced view that Islam creates. They'll look at the death and destruction in Syria and Iraq, and while you and I know that it was America that made this possible, they won't blame America for what America actually did. What America actually did is we removed the secular dictator from Iraq, gave the people the opportunity to vote for their government, and they chose a government that is completely run by Iran. The jihadists aren't going to blame America for that. And the death and destruction that has occurred subsequently is all at their hands. So, but they'll come back upside down, enraged and twisted by Islam, and they will perpetrate far greater terrorist events than we witnessed at 9/11.
You know, you talk about how they recruit with blood and gore and violence and that sort of thing. At least our military has the decency to recruit with deceptive promises of career development, world travel, health care, GI Bill, and a contract date for their discharge.
You know, that
repeatedly.
Yeah, you know, that I think was the primary recruitment technique for many years, and it's still occasionally mentioned. But if you look at most military ads, you know, you have the U.S. Navy, a force for good, and during those ads, they will show over 60 seconds, like 20 different weapon systems. And so it's a chance to play video games for real is what they're essentially selling. And then if you look at the Army ones, they're all about how your parents should encourage you to go become become molded by the Army so that you're a tough killing machine. I mean, they show these people then engaged in battles on foreign soil. And so the idea is, let us have your son or daughter, and we will turn them into this. And so it's they're selling the very different thing now. I mean, they really are selling the death and destruction of the military. They of course aren't telling the parents that about 80 veterans take their lives through suicide every day, and they aren't telling the parents that if you're sending your girl into the military, she has a greater chance of being raped and sexually harassed than she does anywhere else in the world, including being in an Islamic country. So it's a selective right. release of information.
Right. Right. Exactly. But also, I was thinking on the news. This is a bit of a digression, but thinking of you were talking about the different Islamic nations earlier. Mm-hmm. But I don't think you made much mention of the Islamic island nations of the Pacific. You know, they have Indonesia and a lot of Muslims in the Philippines and Malaysia. Right. And which made me think of, you know, Malaysia. Of course, you have this second Malaysian airline disaster now where a plane went, where, you know, this plane's been shot down over the Ukraine. And this is just horrific. Obama's been on the phone with Putin about this. And it's like, I seriously hope, I'm not joking, I seriously hope somebody's taking a look and see if anybody bought a large number of puts on Malaysian Airlines, you know, today, because, or yesterday or something, you know. Like, how could anybody be dumb enough to shoot down a passenger liner, you know, over there? And, like, in a way, why would you fly over the war zone if you could divert a little bit, you know, away from the, at least away from the hottest areas?
Yeah, but, particularly since in this particular case, you know that the Ukrainian government is using aircraft to bomb civilian areas, and the ethnic Russians who live in those areas have a choice. They can either catch the bombs or they can fire missiles at the airplanes to bring them down. Now, if you're in that kind of a situation and you're flying an airliner where you know that there is bombing activity by the government, and there is surface-to-air missiles being deployed against it by the those on the ground. I mean, you would have to be stupid with a capital S as large as Mount Everest to fly a commercial airliner there. Why would you do that?
I got to wonder what other traffic has been going over and why this hasn't been voluntarily diverted, you know, systematically, you know, just as a matter of course because of all this. But then the other thing is, I mean, the airliners should have been cruising at a prohibitively high altitude. I mean, you should probably have a 35, 37,000 feet.
Yeah, it would be in the mid-30s, but at the same time, the Ukrainian government, the Kiev government, has been flying troop transports into Donetsk for the purpose of bringing more soldiers to the battle, and those on the ground have brought down troop transport. But you talk about, you know, the Islamic world with airports. The, you know, Pakistan's largest city, Karachi, Pakistan, the airport is not serviceable anymore. In Tripoli and Libya, not only is the airport gone, I mean, the airport is completely devastated. They've destroyed every airplane at the airport. They've destroyed all of the infrastructure at the airport. There are no flights, and there won't be any flights there for a very long period of time. And it's only a matter of time before the airports in Baghdad become dysfunctional, so you can't get people and supplies in and out of that country. You know, I know it is a different topic, but I was devastated when I read that Obama is imposing more sanctions on Russia. I mean, Obama ought to be wake up every day and kissing Putin's ring. If it wasn't for Putin and what he did with Syria, removing the chemical weapons, the United States would have started World War III. We'd be in the midst of World War III right now, and the world as we know it would be going up in smoke. If it wasn't for Putin, the United States would be in World War III. But beyond that, the United States is the aggressor in Ukraine. We inspired the rebels who took over Kiev by force and removed the popularly elected government. And then we are funding and encouraging the use of weapons. The U.S. taxpayers are paying for the weapon systems that are being deployed by the Kiev government against the people who voted over 95% to disassociate from Kiev. And yet, rather than take responsibility for any of that, the United States is blaming Russia for essentially defending its own citizens. And all the while, we're trying to deal with a country we absolutely destroyed in Iraq, another country that we destroyed in Syria, and we don't have a clue how to deal with that or the fact that we had another failed election in Afghanistan. And speaking of airports, the Kandahar airport was attacked yesterday and nearly destroyed.
Right.
I mean, we ought to be just apologizing. We ought to be crawling in a hole. And yet we're out tongue-lashing and putting sanctions on the world. You know, when I was reading the End Times Prophecy and you were trying to figure out how in the world do you get a nuclear holocaust where you get countries that haven't been at war with each other, you know, for decades back engaged in a war footing, the United States and Russia. But the Obama administration's treatment of Russia and China, it's easy to see how we're going to push them into a war footing against us.
We're funding Islamofascists and neo-Nazi fascists in various places around the world, and the junta governments, and it's like this is just insane. And actually, I was thinking about you talking about the Islamic predilection for bringing about death rather than life. That's not true. I'm not arguing that. But in terms of sheer numbers, if you think about the number of deaths that American foreign policy has caused directly and indirectly worldwide over the past quarter of a century. It's phenomenal. We've caused ultimately far more deaths than the drug handlers of AKs have.
Of course. You look at the proxy war in Afghanistan under Carter. 1.5 million Afghanis died. You look at our war in Vietnam.
Under Clinton.
No-fly
zone under Clinton in Iraq.
Right. You look at the people who starved as a result of that. The most accurate, most complete death count in Iraq shows that ultimately 1 million people died as a result of our second invasion of Iraq. I don't know how many millions of Vietnamese died because of our invasion of Vietnam, but it's in the millions. There's just no question. The United States, directly with its military, has been extraordinarily deadly, leading to the deaths of many millions of people. But we're the primary merchants of death. We make the most sophisticated, most popular, most deadly killing machines. That is our lead economic manufacturing capability these days is machines that kill. And we are the world's leaders in that technology. And it does not impress God. He is not happy with us. The 18th chapter of Isaiah begins with a woe. Not happy in the least with America. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I do want to finish the story of the world falling apart by Islam. They're talking about, first of all, in Libya, or last of all, really, in Libya, in terms of this article. The United States, orchestrated by both the Barack Hussein Obama, who is dangerous. I mean, he is so dangerous to Americans. And Senator John McClellan of Arizona decided that we should bomb Libya because Muammar Gaddafi, bad guy, not thinking through that if we got Muammar Gaddafi ousted, the only government then would be a collection of Islamic terrorist organizations, and that's precisely what we got, is a terrorist state. Well, today, Tripoli's airport has been devastated, demolished, really. 90% of the planes there are no longer flyable. And there's no money to repair them. There's no technology to repair them. All of the fuel tanks that would service the airplanes have been blown up. All of the trucks, all of the maintenance buildings, everything, even the control tower, it's in shambles. The chaos in the capital is now so dire between fighting militant groups. Where are you, John McClellan, taking credit for all of this? You know, you took credit for bombing Libya. You went there and told us how wonderful all of these jihadists were. How, yeah, they might be Muslims, but they're freedom fighters. Yeah, you told us that, John. Well, now the Tripoli is nothing but a war zone. Hell. Now, why should we care? Well, we should care because we made it that way. That's why we should care. Ultimately, the United States is responsible for providing the weapons that overturned these governments, that made a bad situation worse. Yeah, Saddam Hussein was a bad guy. The government of Iraq is vastly worse now, and beyond that, the country is broken. It's in shatters. It's engulfed in religious war. We're responsible. You know, we have broken everything. And if I were Putin, I would have come out with an open letter. He speaks beautiful English to the American people and say, you know, your president is a disaster, America. He was on the wrong side in Syria. He made the mess in Iraq. He is on the wrong side in the Ukraine. He is the instigator of the violence there. He is a disaster for your country economically. He is a disaster internationally. He's a laughingstock. Your NSA is making enemies around the world with its spying on everyone. Putin could come out and say, what is it that America has done that has been productive? I can give you the list of what they've done that's been counterproductive. His speech in Cairo that ignited this Islamic reformation that brought Egypt to its knees, destroyed the country. Same thing with Libya. Same thing with Tunisia. Same thing with Syria. Same thing with Iraq. Yeah, he's created nothing but disasters around the world. And now he's taunting both Russia and China, pushing the world toward war. All the while he wrecks the U.S. economy. All the while he touts a broken healthcare system that is further bankrupting the country. All the while he has driven up greater debt than all other presidents combined. Yeah, if I were Putin, I'd write an open letter to the citizens of the United States. They might listen, might be an intelligent debate over what we've become, the laughingstock of the world. Now, in today's program, I'm going to do something that I haven't done in a while, but I'm going to do it in response to the feedback we received yesterday, which is that I am going to use an hour and a half for insights into our relationship with God. And that insights are also going to involve exposing and condemning that which is untrue and unreliable as it relates to God. We're going to continue to expose Paul's letters. Now, before I go there, I had another good friend write me about the series of shows we did on pharmaceutical companies. And this particular friend made the comment that if it were not for a particular pharmaceutical that he takes, which deals with the fluid buildup around his heart, he would long since been dead. And this email that he was corresponding to was related to an email that I received from a friend who has a marvelous website, and I want to share the URL of that website. It is Shamar Emet. Shamar, which means to observe, Emet, E-M-E-T, which means truth, .wordpress.com. Shamar Emet, WordPress. Okay, you can sue me, but I'm going to welch on a promise. I am going to speak briefly about this Malaysian airliner that was shot down before we move on to questioning Paul. Because the world's going to react, and and the way the world's going to react is going to be straightforward. The world's going to blame Russia for supplying the ethnic Russians who are trying to defend themselves for the shooting down the airplane. And we need to be careful here. And I always want to be a voice of reason before that occurs. The United States has shot down commercial airlines, and we have vastly more capability in terms of surveillance systems, radar systems, tracking systems, satellite systems, than do these ethnic Russians that are trying to defend themselves in Donetsk. And yet in the Persian Gulf, a U.S. Destroyer shot down and killed everybody aboard an Iranian commercial airliner. The airliner was absolutely no threat to the U.S. wasn't flying towards the ship, wasn't doing anything that could be considered menacing. We have all the technology in the world, and yet we shot it down. And in this case, the ethnic Russians and the Donetsk, because they are trying to liberate themselves from the Kiev government, don't have all of that. Now, here's the people you could blame. You could say, well, Russia has supported Russians, their citizens, their people, from the aggression that is being perpetrated against them by the Kiev government. And so you could be like Putin and blame Russia. But Russia would be grotesquely immoral if it wasn't protecting its people, if it wasn't helping them defend themselves. You could blame the Russians for supplying the anti-aircraft weapon, but we don't know that they did. The anti-aircraft missile could have been taken from one of the bases that the Russian ethnic Russians seized early in this conflict. It could have also been manufactured in the Donetsk region. Much of Russia's military hardware was made in Donetsk. It is the largest concentration of manufacturing capability for military hardware on what was part of Russia and should be part of Russia again. It always bothers me a great deal when people aren't able to choose liberty. And in the case of Donetsk, the people chose to be separated from the Kiev government overwhelmingly. And it is so hypocritical for us to say that the vote that the Ukrainians took to separate from the Soviet Union counts, matters, but the vote that the ethnic Russians took in Donetsk to separate from Kiev doesn't count. It's kind of like the United States Civil War, with nothing civil about it, where the South's vote to join the Union counts, but the South's votes to disassociate from the Union, well, that didn't count. They didn't have the freedom of choice. Now, you could blame the ethnic Russians for firing the rocket. And yet to be careful there, because now the Kiev government is flying bombing missions over them. And they're killing civilians with those bombing missions. And they're also flying troop transports. And the best way to safeguard your people is to bring down the troop transports and bring down the bombers. Now, it's true that no one is going to confuse a bomber at 33,000 feet with a commercial airliner. But be careful, because the troop transports would look identical to the commercial airliner. And so you have to be careful in blaming them. If you have the capability to protect those you love from an aggressor that was bombing them from the air, would you? You could blame the Kiev government for not listening to the will of the Donetsk population and for choosing to turn their military against those people. You could blame the United States for not honoring the will of the people's democracy, freedom, and paying for all of that. You could blame the Malaysians for the stupidity of flying a commercial airliner over a known war zone where there have been increasingly bombing raids, troop transports, and missiles fired, bringing down aircraft. So lots of people to blame. Lots of people share culpability. It is a tragedy. No one wanted this to happen. But be careful who you blame. That said, I would like to, I should say a couple more things. One is that there were 295 people on that aircraft that are now dead. The flight left Amsterdam and was headed to, I believe, Kuala Lumpur. And that's a tragedy for those people. And it, by the way, I'm sure it's a tragedy for the person who fired the anti-aircraft missile. But we need to be careful again in assessing blame. There are places we do not need to be careful in assessing blame, and one of them is with Paul. Unlike all of Yahweh's actual prophets, who served as scribes and had simply wrote down what Yahweh said, Paulus was different. He spoke as if he were God, and he had a scribe. And his most common line is, "But I say," where "I" represents Paul, not Yahweh, speaking in first person. This differentiates the self-proclaimed wannabe apostle and his epistles from the actual word of God. It also positions Paulus as the lead candidate for the false apostle in Ephesus, for the wolf in sheep's clothing at the conclusion of the Sermon on the Mount. It positions Paul as the one who came in his own name, who would be received, where Yahusha, who came in his father's name, would be rejected. And folks, if you think of Yahweh's warnings regarding this, and particularly Yahweh's warning through the prophet Habakkuk, where he said that Paul was the plague of death, called him out by name, there are no other candidates. God told you as clearly as words allow that Paul was a fraud, the plague of death, a false apostle, a false prophet, a wolf in sheep's clothing, the one who comes in his own name to get those to reject the one who came in his father's name. As a result of this and other stylistic choices, the animosity and the egotism that permeates Paul's letters, they contain some of the most difficult passages to translate because they're just poorly written. There are many missing words, and Paul's epistles are famous for the run-on sentences. Moreover, in Galatians, Paul is being attacked. He's on the defensive, and he's being attacked by those who listened to his message. Those who knew him best rejected him. If you read the letters, the first communities that Paul wrote to, the Galatians, the Corinthians, and the Thessalonians, what you find is that each of those three communities Paul spoke to, once Paul left, they said, "Man, that guy was full of it." They rejected him. And Paul is tongue-lashing them for rejecting him. That's the nature of all three of those, the letters to those communities. He is being denounced. Those who knew him best, those who actually listened to him, knew that he was a fraud. And so Galatians is Paul on the defensive, trying to justify his persona, his authority, his doctrine, and especially that which he has written and said that is in direct conflict with the Torah. And how do you pretend that you're speaking for the God who authored the Torah when in fact everything you said is in conflict with that Torah? Now, his claim of being an apostle was not just being questioned, it was being rejected. He was not a witness to Yahusha's words and deeds. You know, if Yahweh wanted Paul to be one of his disciples, that was easy. Paul was there in Jerusalem. He was studying religion. If Yahusha wanted Paul to be his chosen one, he would have chosen him. He was there in Jerusalem at the same time Yahusha was there. He didn't choose him. In fact, he rejected everything he stood for. As it relates to Galatia, it was a Roman province in Asia Minor, modern-day Turkey, which extended to the Black Sea from the middle of the Turkish peninsula. It began just north of where Paul was born. The Galatians were originally Gauls, but, you know, Gaul was a term, or in typically the Romans like to call the Gauls Celts, but almost everyone that wasn't a Roman was a Gaul or a Celt, and then they were the Gauls and Vandals, but you know, enormous numbers of people were given that title. Anyway, they moved down the Rhine to mix with Greeks and Jews. They were known for their quick temper, their prompt action, their inconsistency, and their malleability. Shaul knew them well. He had traveled throughout their land in pursuit of his mission. Now, as we will do throughout this review of Galatians, here is the Nestle Aland, the Latin Vulgate, and the King James renditions of the second verse. And the reason I'm doing this, I've now shared my translation with you. But in every case, we're also going to share at least four others. We're going to share the McReynolds Interlinear that is that accompanies the Nestle Aland, because it's the most scholastically revered. We're going to share the Latin Vulgate because for better part of 1,500 years, it was the dominant text. In fact, all English translations really are a translation of the Latin Vulgate. And then we're going to change, quote the King James because of its profound influence on Europe and the Americas, even though it's a pile of lies. And then also the New Living Translation. You'll have many to consider. Welcome back to Shattering This. Trying to clear the air, I may have clouded it, and I want to withdraw something that I said. In the Ukrainian battle, the Kiev government has lied about most everything. They are probably the least credible group of people on the planet today in their claims. And the report that I was reading and I was sharing with you, a Reuters report, said that the plane had been shot down by the rebels using XYZ anti-aircraft capability. Actually, that claim was simply a quotation that came out of the Kiev government. The ethnic Russians in Donetsk deny that they shot down the airplane. Andrei Pergin, deputy prime minister for the Donetsk People's Republic, said that the insurgent group in the east did not shoot down the airplane. He said that the rebels had shot down Ukrainian military planes before, but that their anti-aircraft weapons could only reach around 4,000 meters, about 12 to 13,000 feet, about a third of the altitude of a passenger jetliner. This aircraft was at 33,000 feet. He said, "We do not have the technical ability to hit a plane at that altitude." Said the plane apparently came down in an area of Ukrainian military operations, and it was not out of the question that the Ukrainians shot it down. Then he said, "Remember the Black Sea plane disaster?" He was referring to the 2001 attack on a passenger jet that was bound for Israel that the Ukrainians shot down by accident during a military training exercise. Of course, the Ukrainians are the single most anti-Semitic and actively enraged and violent anti-Semitic people on earth. And so them accidentally shooting down an Israeli aircraft bound for Israel is par for the course for the Ukraine. And I share this additional information with you because it is unfair to say at this point that this aircraft was brought down by ethnic Russians as opposed to someone else in the region. Or that we don't even know for certain at this point that it was brought down by a missile, although that is the likely scenario. But it's nothing but speculation at this point. And when a Kiev political spokesperson makes a statement, you should always disregard it. They are lying. The vast preponderance of the time. All right, now I want to return to the second statement that Paul made. It's actually the first statement because it's a run-on sentence, but the sentence is so long that they've broken it into many verses. The Nestle Allen McReynolds Interlinear says, "And thee with me, all brothers, to the assemblies of the Galatia." The Latin Vulgate conveys, "and all the brothers who are with me to the Ecclesis Galatae," of which the King James published, "and all the brethren who are with me unto the churches of Galatia." In this case, the most egregious error cannot be blamed on the Latin Vulgate, which is the change from called out to church. It's worth restating that very few things in Christendom have been as harmful as changing ecclesia, which means called out, to church. It created the impression that the Christian caricature known as Jesus Christ had conceived a new Christian institution to replace the chosen people, and that this religious construct was somehow unrelated to Yahweh's seven invitations to be called out and meet with him, his feasts, and even with his Shabbat, Sabbath. And it led to the notion that the feasts were nothing more than quaint Jewish holidays. But now, you know who is to blame for this devastating corruption of the text. The Rosicrucian Francis Bacon, serving the political interest of King Iams, was the first to perpetuate this grievous and damning corruption. His predecessors, such as John Wycliffe, either transliterated ecclesia or wrote a sermon.